even up to today, you find that the infrastructure in Africa is oriented towards trading with external partners. What this deal is aiming at is reversing that historical anomaly.
An historic turning point's been reached, with 44 countries signing up to create the first ever African Continental Free Trade Area. But what will it mean for ordinary citizens, and can the economic tigers of Nigeria and South Africa be brought on board? This is UN and Africa from UN News. I'm Matt Wells. In a moment, we'll hear from the first UN force commander to arrive in Liberia 15 years ago, as the UN mission there winds up on Saturday, with the future looking bright for now. And we'll find out what protecting civilians means today for the UN in war-torn South Sudan. But first, let's hear from David Luke, the coordinator of the African Trade Policy Centre, which is part of the UN Economic Commission for Africa, UNECA. The commission drove the UN contribution to negotiations for the free trade area, which brings together more than a billion people, and hopes that trade between African nations can increase more than 50% in the next 4 years, compared with levels in 2010. I asked David to outline what Africa had achieved with the Kigali Declaration last week.
The first effort ever in Africa's post-independence history to negotiate and sign a trade deal that covers the entire continent. And this is coming after 10 rounds of negotiations, many, many years of deliberations as to why the continent needs to open up to trade better among itself.
And we've got a total of 44 countries so far who've actually signed, but there are more waiting in the wings, aren't there?
Yes, and this is not unusual. Firstly, all the member states of the African Union participated in the negotiations and all made commitments to the modalities that were agreed, the final legal text of the agreements, etc. But it's not unusual that prior to signing, various countries need to follow their respective internal political processes to build consensus. So what we found is that, which has been most talked about, is that Nigeria, one of the biggest economy on the continent, did not sign the legal instruments and wants more time to be able to consult internally. South Africa signed what is known as the Kigali Declaration. This is basically a promissory note saying that they would ratify the agreement after the internal processes have been completed. A number of other countries do have the leeway in the sense that the executive, their president or prime minister or foreign minister, is empowered under their constitutions, their respective constitutions, to sign agreements of this nature. So given the number of countries, given different constitutional traditions, given different political processes, this is something that is coming out of the African Union. It's a flagship project of the Agenda 2063. So we do expect over time that all the issues that remain to be addressed will be addressed, and this thing would fly.
So we're some years away from being in a sort of situation such as the European Union, which is, obviously a fully flowing free trade area.
No, the model is not the European Union at all, and I think it's a mistake to assume that what this deal is about is creating an African European Union. This is just a free trade area agreement. It is an agreement on trading goods and trading services, and there will be a second phase that will look at cooperation in some specific areas. The European Union is a single market. This is not what the African Union is seeking to create at this point. It's simply seeking to bring down the tariffs between African countries, which is currently about 6%, to bring it down to zero, and then also to deal with non-tariff barriers. And even in bringing down the tariffs to zero, this will be for only about 90% of tariff lines. The remaining 10% will be phased in.
So how is this going to influence and impact ordinary Africans' lives? I mean, what kind of benefits can regular people expect to see as a result of this in the years ahead?
You know, history shows that everywhere you trade with your neighbors, even from ancient societies. If I am a hunter, I go and kill meat. I come and exchange it with you, my neighbor, if you are planting grain or something like that. So throughout history, this is how trade develops. You trade with your neighbors. Now, the unfortunate thing for Africa is that trade was directed outside of the continent rather than between neighbors. So even up to today, you find that the infrastructure in Africa is oriented towards trading with external partners. What this deal is aiming at is reversing that historical anomaly, especially since research already shows that the trade between African countries, though relatively small, is very promising compared with the trade outside of the continent. In terms of how this would affect everyday Africans, by opening up the continent, creating more opportunities for small businesses to grow and expand, there's already much informal cross-border trade on the African continent. Much of it is even undocumented. So creating more opportunities would impact the lives of ordinary Africans on a daily basis.
Now, Moussa Faki Mahamat, who's chairperson of the African Union Commission, said at this signing last week that Africa's a sleeping giant that can't wake up if the continent is divided. Do you think that that message is fundamental to the thinking behind most countries signing up?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There are 54, depending on how you want to count them, 55 relatively small economies. It's difficult for big investments to be made to scale in such a fragmented context. So this is actually one of the other benefits of the of this deal, that it does mean that investors can look at the continent not just as a collection of 54 countries, but could actually look to see where investments could be best placed with a sure knowledge that there is the legal underpinning that the other country markets could equally be accessed.
Do you think this is also going to help boost development in those poorest nations where obviously development is a huge issue?
Yeah, this again, there's been a lot of research on this, which shows that many countries would become part of regional supply chains which feed into global value chains. Again, let me just add parenthetically here that by creating a free trade area and reducing tariffs among the African countries does not mean that Africa does not want to trade with external partners. In fact, quite the contrary. The thinking is that as you develop regional supply chains, you'll be better placed to participate in global value chains. And this is backed by much research, which is showing that African economies would be able to enter global value chains at a higher level of value addition. This would boost development. It would have an impact on employment. There have even been studies to show how women would be impacted, because women are quite a force in Africa when it comes to cross-border trade.
So this does justify the use of the word historic, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, this is the first time, in the post-colonial history that the countries are coming together to say that they want to create a free trade area spanning the whole of the continent. They've tried this before on a sub-regional basis. So we do have regional economic communities like ECOWAS or SADC or COMESA, etc. The limitation is that the big economies, which are expected to be growth pools, which would be the engine for these regional value chains I'm talking about, are not all in the same economic grouping. So you have, Egypt, Nigeria, South Africa, Kenya, just to name four relatively big, the four biggest economies, each in different groupings.
But clearly the addition of Nigeria and South Africa will be a huge boost to this new engine of growth for the continent, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. We are quite positive that this will happen. As I said, it's not unusual that at this point that some countries would want to have these internal consultative processes. Of course, we've seen press reports wondering what would be the fate of this deal if these two countries don't participate. But we are confident their involvement from the get-go has been very strong. The negotiations were launched in South Africa in 2015 in Johannesburg. So again, from the get-go, you know, they were all very much a part of this, but they do have processes to follow. And just one quick example, you'd recall that some months ago, Canada and the EU concluded a deal. As the deal was about to be signed, the signing had to be postponed because Belgium was objecting to some provisions in the agreement because a group in Flanders, Belgium, wanted clarification of some of the provisions.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
So the Canadian Prime Minister was all set to fly to Brussels and to postpone his trip. So you do have these sorts of things happening before trade deals signed and they come into effect. So I think this is what we're seeing here. But you know, I mean, should the worst happen, then of course it would mean that it would be a lost opportunity for Africa, but we don't think that that is going to happen.
David Luke, coordinator at the African Trade Policy Centre for the UN Economic Commission for Africa. Thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome, Matthew.
Now, with hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese reliant on the UN mission in the country, UNMISS, for protection, the list of challenges facing Gilbert Nansa and his colleagues is a long one. But the current officer in charge of civilian protection across South Sudan says that their three-pillar approach to protect through physical, political and environmental action is holding firm despite continuing conflict. UNMISS has responsibility to protect around 200,000 living in specific sites, but also several million who've been internally displaced through years of fighting between rival factions. I asked Gilbert, who was at UN headquarters this month for a Protection of Civilians, or POC, conference organised by UN Peacekeeping, how important it was to the mission's overall mandate.
We have settlements that are directly under the control of the mission, because when the conflict erupted in 2013, many people showed up at the gate, and then we opened the gate, the mission opened the gate to provide them protection from physical violence. To date, this number is around 200,000 people. They're mainly in Juba, Bentiu, Malakal.
That's the capital.
Juba is the capital. Bentiu, Malakal, Bo, and very recently also in Wau. So this is where we have POC sites. But beyond that, we have other internal displaced persons throughout the country, which also numbered in terms of close to 2 million, which the mission also has the mandate to protect.
So it's a huge number of people, isn't it?
Yes, 200,000 is huge. Regarding the responsibility the mission has to towards them, providing them physical protection from physical violence.
And the fact is that violence is ongoing in the country. There is still a lot of political instability. What are the main concerns for you every day?
The main concern is, of course, to have them safe, and we are deploying a lot of resources in doing that. And it's another challenge for the mission, because just securing the 200,000 individual displaced IDPs, it's just part of the POC mandate. We should protect people beyond the POC sites. But yet, yes, this is a big challenge, because the mission has to allocate a lot of resources in providing that, but at the same time also think of providing protection beyond these sites. We have protection challenges beyond the country, and as you mentioned, the situation still volatile, still not really stabilized, so still the challenge of protection of civilians are throughout the country.
I mean, I know that UNMISS has got this approach that obviously you don't want to have these protection sites become permanent settlements. You want, where possible, to start allowing people to return home to their villages. What's the sort of procedure that you're trying to adopt as far as that's concerned? Having people go home when possible.
Yes, we are insisting on the voluntary return. They are the one to decide where to return. So the mission is working very hard to ensure that. Very recently, we have noticed some kind of movement in and out the POCs, maybe from other POCs, from one POC to another, or from the POC outside, and also the movement from people outside to the POC. There is a bit of dynamism, but the mission is thinking how, and the mission aims at providing protective environment beyond to boost and to facilitate the return. Voluntary return.
The ethnic fault lines within South Sudan society have been there for generations. I mean, how can UNMISS and how can you, in your with your remit of protecting civilians, how can you help to bring communities together and resolve differences It's obviously a huge challenge, I imagine.
It is one, but let me emphasize that we work on the three pillar, on the three tier of protection of civilian. Tier one is protection through political processes. Tier two is providing physical protection, and tier three is working on a protective environment. And the mission has various components who are doing a lot. I may cite here civil affairs, what they are doing in terms of social cohesion, intercommunal conflict, mediation, and so on. So yes, there is a challenge of community living together, but yet the mission is also working to bring this community together and making sure that they can resort to live again despite the conflict that occurred in the country. So a lot is being done at all this tier to make sure that there is some kind of convivial cohabitation among the communities in the country.
And what's been the value of coming to UN headquarters for you? And you've been here, you've been exchanging ideas with others who are involved, others who are in the kind of leadership role in terms of civilian protection. What's been useful about this week for you?
What has been useful is to share our own experience, because we have few things we are doing well. And I noticed around the table that our early warning and early response in the country is very well organized, and we are doing our utmost to have that happening. We have an early warning matrix which is updated weekly, and the senior management is looking into it. If there is any way to provide a response, is provided as soon as possible on a preemptive way. So we have this robust posture, proactive and nimble presence throughout the country. The country is designed like we have escounted effect of the deployment. We don't just deploy, but we deploy anticipating some effect of our deployment. So I share our own experience in UNMISS, which was of added value to other colleagues, which I also at the other time listened to them and then got some feedback which would be useful when I get home. That's not only all, but also coming to the HQ was an opportunity for us to listen to those who are working on our various mission, and also to convey some maybe points that they already been following up, but talking to them face to face always make a difference. So it's and also listening and hearing from the senior and various colleagues from the HQ, how the HQ function and how they are supportive to our work, on how they can support our work in the field.
That was Gilbert Nansa of UNMISS. Finally, for this UN and Africa podcast from UN News, we've a UN success story seen through the eyes of one senior military commander who, when he first arrived in Liberia, must have wondered if Saturday would ever come. That's when UNMIL, the UN mission there that's been in place since two civil wars finally petered out in 2003, will officially come to a close. In the heat of the crisis, Lieutenant General Daniel Opande entered an insecure, unstable country and managed to get all the warring factions to lay down their arms. This resulted in 100,000 former combatants disarming. Our colleague Kingsley Ikobor from the Africa Renewal Information Programme got in touch with General Opande and asked how it looked when he first got there.
There was nothing functional in Liberia. The government more or less had collapsed. There was no security arrangement or a security arm which was functional. The entire country was in turmoil. People were moving from place to place, either looking for a place where they could feel a little safe or where there was something to eat.
Given the situation in Liberia that you have just described for us, how confident were you that you could bring the situation under control?
I said, I can't do, everything, to bring back peace, but we are going to work on it. We are going to work on it with the people of Liberia and see to it that we can achieve what the people of Liberia want, for us. And that is to return the country back into some sort of semblance of peace and stability.
Okay, how were you able to organize or mobilize the many generals from the various factions to accept peace?
I actually attempted and did exactly what I had done in Sierra Leone. Reach out to various guerrilla or rebel factions, targeted their leaders. And instead of sitting down in Monrovia, for example, expecting them to come to me and discuss with me how we could resolve, you know, the enormous security situation, I went out to them. I was not afraid to go wherever it was, whatever it takes, to go and meet with people like General Sharif, which was their LAD commander, or go out into the northern part of Liberia, you know, Banga, you know, to meet with the local, you know, leaders there. And when I say leaders, it was military leaders as well as sometimes, you know, political leaders. I went out to them and discussed with them and made sure that they realized what they need to do themselves to return peace into their local communities or throughout the country. I had no choice. I had been given a job to do, the false commander, and to make it work. So fear was not anything that was in my utmost, you know, mind.
How easy was it leading a multinational force with probably with varying degrees, levels of training, who are used to different types of equipment, and maybe different levels of motivation?
It is not an easy task. You know, when you lead a multinational force which has got different languages, different equipment, different, you know, ethics and things like that, but you have to bring them together. That is where the leadership is, you know, required to bring everyone on board. And that has always been probably my strongest, point in leadership. I bring everyone on board, and I make sure that right from me as the force commander and goes all the way down to the most junior commander in whichever or from whichever country he or she comes from, understand why we are there and what we are going to do.
A few weeks ago, Liberia had peaceful presidential elections and had a smooth handover of power. Why do you think that peace has endured in Liberia?
The Liberian people are the ones who we must congratulate. The Liberian people realized that they've suffered for so many years because of poor leadership. And as such, once the elections of 2005 succeeded, then they would now get themselves to a proper leadership that puts the country first, the economy, the security, and of course, you know, the people of Liberia. So hopefully they will remain together like that for many years to come.
Amen to that. Former UN Force Commander for the UN mission in Liberia, Daniel Opande, bringing this edition of our UN and Africa podcast to a close on a positive note. I'm Matt Wells here at UN headquarters in New York. Thanks to you for listening, and we'll be back soon.